And welcome to the Nachum Segal Network. This segment is entitled By the Book. A big thank you to our friends at Koren Publications and Magid Books, a division of Koren, for making available to us some of the most amazing authors of our time. Rabbi Beryl Wein is with us via telephone. He's founder and director of the Destiny Foundation. For over 25 years, he's been identified as one of the foremost Jewish Orthodox historians. Rabbi Wein is recipient of the Torah Prize Award from Machon Harav Frank in Yerushalayim for his achievements in teaching Torah and spreading Judaism throughout the world. He's a regular columnist for the Jerusalem Post, author of many books, including Vision and Valor, an Illustrated History of the Talmud, Oral Law of Sinai, and The Legacy, Teachings for Life from the Great Lithuanian Rabbis, also available from Magid Books. The brand new one is Rabbi Beryl Wein, a book entitled Teach Them Diligently, The Personal Story of a Community Rabbi. Yet, yes, it is an autobiographical book from Rabbi Beryl Wein. Rabbi Wein, welcome back to the Nachum Segal Network.
Thank you, Nachum. Very good to be back.
I appreciate that. Mazel tov on the new release.
Thank you.
Can we assume that you've always wanted to write an autobiographical book, or finally you were convinced to do so?
Well, I mentioned in the introduction that I did so at the urging of my grandchildren. It's very difficult to say no to grandchildren, as I'm sure you're aware of. And they wanted to know about our family, and, it's... When it started to be written, so the book like almost wrote itself. The book is about 180 pages long, but if I would have written everything, it would be 600 pages long. I think the wisdom in it is what it doesn't say, than practically what it does say. But I found it to be it's a great catharsis to be able to write. You look back on your life, you look back on your mistakes, you look back on what could have been, you look back on what was achieved. You paint the picture for yourself.
You know, Rabbi Wein, rabbinic biographies rarely contain mistakes. Do rabbinic autobiographies have some?
Well, I'm waiting to see the person who didn't make a mistake yet. I haven't met him. I've met a lot of great people. The greater they are, the more willing they are to say that they made a mistake.
No, no question about that. Just sometimes their biographers take a different approach.
Well, it's one of the ills, so to speak, of the current political correctness in the Jewish world, is that everything is hagiographic.
Yeah.
You know, the guy was born, and by 4 years old, he knew Shas, and he never had a moment's doubt, and he was always happy, and it's not real. It's just, I don't know people like that. I don't think anybody knows people like that. And then we portray them in that way, and we build them up, and we really build ourselves up for the disappointment of eventually realizing that none of that is accurate.
You know, what's interesting about the new book, and I'm sure there are a lot of things interesting about it, but you had, and I don't know if it's fair to paint it this way, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but you've had many different careers.
That's part of the problem. Yep.
You've had many different careers, or at least, yes. Many different types of influences in the Jewish world, community, rabbi, a lawyer, historian, lecturer, Israel, United States, founder of a school. I mean, a whole host of different things, and yet, when it comes time to entitle your biography, to provide the title for it, it's Teach Them Diligently. I guess the central theme is you're always teaching.
I always attempted to teach. I was, I would say that for the last, I would say that really for the last 70 years, I know that sounds... maybe an exaggeration, but I don't think it's much of an exaggeration. I've taught Torah every day of my life.
Amazing. That's something to be proud of, to say the least. You know, a lot of people, I shouldn't say a lot, but you know that I do come from a family that knows something about the community rabbinate. And you mentioned you wrote the book for your grandchildren or with their influence, as we just discussed. I have heard people from the older generations say to those in the younger ones, if there's one occupation you shouldn't go into, it's community rabbi, or they discourage it, especially in, and I'm saying this seriously, not the old, you know, the famous joke. I'm saying that it's not a job for a nice Jewish boy, but I'm saying it seriously because I think that people from the older generation sometimes think that it's simply too difficult with everything that's going on today to be a community rabbinic leader. What do you say to the young people after your experience about pursuing such a pursuit?
Well, you know, to be a community rabbi requires certain talents and it requires a certain personality. If you don't have the talents and you don't have the personality, you're setting yourself up for all of the problems that exist. If you do have the talents and you do have the personality, even though the problems exist, you will be able to, if not overcome them, many of them you'll simply ignore and you'll be able to go ahead. But if you don't have, if you're not secure within yourself, if you don't have a very strong self-image, if you don't have, for want of a better word, a certain amount of cynicism about life, and if you think that you're working for the members of your congregation, when in reality you should think you're working for the entire Jewish people and, so to speak, for God himself, if you don't have that, and it's the wrong profession for you. There's no question about it. And therefore, there are a lot of corpses strewn on the battlefield that are evident. If you do feel that way, I always felt, first of all, I felt I could always be a lawyer, you know. I still have my Bar Association card from Illinois in my pocket. Mm-hmm. So if they don't like me, then I can do something else anyway. But more than that, I always felt that, that I'm not working for people. I'm working for a cause, for a vision. Eventually, that somehow permeates through the synagogue or through the community as well. And you're able to weather a lot of storms. But it's a difficult position, no question. And if you're a rabbi in a large community, if you have hundreds of members, you know, it's a bell curve. If you have a lot of members, so some of them are going to be on each extreme.
Right.
And you're going to be the victim of it. You know, you're the punching bag. But on the other hand, I can think of no more rewarding profession in the world. It's a chance really to really do great things for the Jewish people and to do good things for yourself as well. It can be a most rewarding profession.
So you said,
again, you have to winnow people. You know, I have a story that I tell about my years in the Chicago yeshiva, the Beis Medrash LaTorah, after we were in the Beis Medrash program for 5 years. So then if you wanted to go into the smicha program, you had to be accepted. And there was always a faculty meeting. And even in my time, there were a number of young men that wanted to go to the smicha program, and the faculty decided that they were not the people to go into the rabbinate, and they wouldn't let them into the smicha program. So a mother once came to appeal a decision against her son, that her son was not allowed into the smicha program. And she pointed out that her son was a wonderful student and a very pious young man and such a nice, wonderful young man. How could they not accept him? And so she said to the dean, she said, my son is a tzaddik. And he said in his inimitable fashion, he said, for being a tzaddik, you get olam haba, not smicha. And that rule should remain. I think it's one of the great problems. There are a lot of people in it that shouldn't be in it.
Right.
And because they're in it, so therefore all of these problems occur.
Yeah, no question. Well, like any profession, it's... there's always a select few that excel, Yeah, it's not just the rabbit, and it could be in any
anything. I remember when I was a lawyer, you know, I had an office on LaSalle Street in Chicago. There were 3,000 lawyers on that street. It's not an exaggeration. My own office, I said to an older lawyer that was there, I said, I don't see how I'm going to make it. You know, there are 3,000 lawyers on the street. He said, there aren't 3,000 good ones.
Right.
And that really says it all.
Right. And today as well, and even if it's the rabbit or anything else, you'll only find
anything else, right. You know,
you'll only find a handful of great ones. All right. Beryl Wine is with us. The book is Teach Them Diligently, the personal story of a community rabbi. Our thanks to Koren Publications and Magid Books. You know, you write about some of your influences, those who are Torah giants and community giants that you either knew intimately or came across during your life. Some of those stories are fascinating. But maybe one of the most important messages for your grandchildren and the future generations in general who are reading the book is that the influence of parents and grandparents, not to minimize your experiences with those I just mentioned, the parents and grandparents might be the greatest. And I don't mean to shortchange those of limited background who may not have that type of lineage in prior generations, but you could speak to just how potent and incredible an influence it can be when you have parents and grandparents dedicated to the cause.
Yeah, and you see, we're pretty much a victim of our own success in our time. You send your child over to yeshiva, you send him to a school, whether he's a boy or a girl, so you assign the child's life to the school. Well, it's not the school. When I had the yeshiva in Muncie, so at parent teacher's night, I would say to the parents, I would say, you know, 90% of your son's achievements are the home.
Right.
10% is mazel. The rest is the yeshiva. And so they didn't quite understand what I meant, but that's exactly what I meant.
Right.
And, you know, you the fact that you're paying tuition and sending to a school doesn't relieve you of the burden of being a parent. But in today's world, it's very difficult. It's two-income families. Children, to a certain extent, raise themselves. It's an open world. There are all sorts of influences. It's a dangerous world. Parents and grandparents are certainly more vital today than they were even before. And I cannot emphasize that over enough, how important it is that we invest in our children. It's not only investing in money, it's investing ourselves. And basically, that's what remains. That's what remains from the parents and from the children.
If you're a Chicago boy, how'd you end up on the East Coast before heading to the Holy Land?
Well, I was in Chicago, and I was a lawyer, and I was a businessman. And I had a dear friend. I have a dear friend, Rabbi Aryeh Rotman, who was the head of the Yeshiva Americas HaTorah in Yerushalayim. And he was raised in Miami Beach in a very small congregation. And my Rebbe, Rabbi Kreiswert, Zecher Tzadik Lebracha, would often come to Chicago after he moved to Antwerp. And he always pressured me. He would say, you know, we have enough lawyers in the Jewish world. You know, you should be a Rav. You should be a Rav. And I would tell him, I have no position. I have nowhere to go. Was at a time when the Orthodox rabbinate was had almost dissolved outside of the New York area.
Right.
And one day Rabbi Rotman showed up in my business and he said to me, you know, I'm leaving Miami Beach and you're going to be my successor. And Rabbi Kreiswert told me to come and tell you this. And I if you know Rabbi Rotman, there is no one as holy, really, if there are 36 in the world, he's one of them. But there's no one more persistent than he is either. And he simply wouldn't let me out of the office to go home until I promised him that I would go for a tryout. The tryout was Shavuos time. This was Thanksgiving time, so I didn't hear anything from him for months. I forgot about it. I didn't think it was serious. And then 2 weeks before Shavuos, he called me up and he said, okay, you're coming for Shavuos for the tryout. And I didn't even own I had a white white straw hat and a blue suit. And so I went down there and I studied with the people. It was a very small shul. There were only 39 families. And I studied with the people. Shul's night. I liked them and they liked me. And the whole story is there in the book. But
right.
That's how I came to Miami Beach. And eventually that shul grew into a still in existence now, 50 years later. It's a marvelous synagogue. And so I was in Miami Beach for 8.5 years. And then because of reasons of my children's education, I wanted to move to the New York area. I had quite a number of offers, but I ended up being with the OU and the OU Kashrus. But I knew that that was not really going to be my career. I wanted always to have a shul after I had the shul in Miami Beach. And so when we moved to Muncie, a group of people, I taught the shiurim, and a group of people gathered around, and we built a wonderful shul, and then we built the yeshiva there, etc.
So you were actively recruited to head to the rabbi. You're like the young Wall Street whiz who's actively recruited to start a hedge fund.
Yeah, I was, it's interesting that in all of my positions, so to speak, I didn't have to look for one.
Right.
I just fell into it. Even now in Yerushalayim, I moved to Yerushalayim, I tell you, I didn't think I was going to be a Rav again. Certainly, it wouldn't be Zocha to be a Rav in Yerushalayim, and then it just happened.
Are you aware that the Orthodox Union now gives supervision over 700,000 kosher products?
Well, it's many more than my time. So my time, I think, was also a breakthrough. The first time we went into meat, went into other things, we expanded it. But, you know, we operated a three-man office.
Right.
And it was a different thing. But I cannot tell you how important the OU is in the Jewish world, and not only in terms of food, but in terms of the fact that it made Judaism acceptable in American society, acceptable. You know, people, the non-Jewish world looked for kosher products as well. I would say that my association with Empire Poultry, and that there was a period of time when I was there that 25% of all of the poultry that was sold under the Empire label was sold to non-Jews.
Right.
And I always said that they said it tastes better. It tastes better because it's got salt in it.
Mm-hmm.
And so they like the salt. But, so it became acceptable, and acceptable in the supermarkets, acceptable everywhere, which contributes to the fact that Jews were able to be in the mainstream of American life without, so to speak, sacrificing Torah observance.
Right. And you mentioned Muncie, of course, and so many of us remember you from the Muncie community, the high school, et cetera, et cetera. If this is an interesting work to those who want to hear about, you know, 20th century America, especially from the perspective of a community rabbi, you as the community rabbi up there probably witnessed one of the most interesting evolutions of a Jewish community of our time. Wouldn't you say that Muncie was certainly, as an observer, obviously you were a participant as well, but as an observer of the broader community up there, was a very interesting historical evolution.
Yes, and the Muncie that I knew, it's not the Muncie of today.
Right.
The Muncie that I knew was less fractured. We all had to live together. I felt very fortunate. I had a relationship with the Square Rebbe. I had a relationship with Rashi Yeshiva in Muncie. I had a relationship with other Rabbonim in Muncie. I had a relationship even with non-Orthodox people in Muncie. There was a Rav that was in this mixed pew congregation, and whenever he felt that he had congregants that were ready to move on, he would send them to my shul.
Right.
And they became, they came in and they became truly Orthodox. Today, you can't, even if you talk about it, people look at it like you're out of your mind.
Rabbi Beryl Wein is with us, brand new, Teach Them Diligently, the personal story of a community rabbi. I want to ask you about during the heart of your community rabbi era, how involved both rabbis and lay people were when it came to the state of Israel, and if that's at all different today in terms of the level of dedication. But can we start this segment with you telling this audience what it was like to be on the other end of the news when the state of Israel was declared?
Well, I cannot. The Jewish people were absolutely on the floor in 1946, 47, 48. The Holocaust finally became real in our eyes. We had no hope. England wouldn't let the Jews into the land of Israel. The Arabs said they're going to throw us into the sea, be another Holocaust. And it was a time, it has to be said, it was a time when anti-Semitism in America was not only alive and well, it was public and accepted. Mm-hmm. It was part of the American scene. And arrival, the creation of the State of Israel was an enormously momentous event that changed our lives. I mean, I remember my father, a blessed memory, is that my father was a Lithuanian Talmud Chochem, you know, a Rav. And my father was not an especially publicly emotional person. But that Friday afternoon when we walked to shul, after the State of Israel had been declared, I remember he wept every step of the way. And that Sunday, there was a rally on behalf of Israel in the Chicago Stadium that we all went to. And all the Rosh Yeshiva went also to the rally, even though none of them were Zionists. Because everybody felt that this was like a historic moment. Something happened here. Lo Dovor Hu. And the ceremony, there were 20,000 Jews in the stadium, and there were another 20, 30,000 outside the stadium in the surrounding area where they had loudspeakers. And in the stadium, the program began by the raising of the Israeli flag to the rafters of the Chicago Stadium. And when that happened, it was a sea of tears. I mean, the whole 2,000 years poured out. It took them 10, 15 minutes to get the program started. And in retrospect, I always felt that it was a mistake to have the program. They should simply have said, now everybody go home.
Right.
Because all the speeches and everything, I mean, Golda Meir was there. All of that was anticlimactic. Because all of a sudden, you know, it happened. It wasn't supposed to happen. It's not supposed to happen theologically. It's not supposed to happen logically. It's not supposed to happen diplomatically. It's not supposed to happen militarily. It's not supposed to happen, and it happened. So that was the feeling then, and that's what's missing today in the whole attitude towards the State of Israel, is that people don't realize you're 100% right. It wasn't supposed to happen. Whether you're left, secular, right, Sotner, whatever, you're right. This wasn't supposed to happen, but it happened. And once it happened, then what do we do with it? That's our task today. So, I always felt that I lived through a very momentous time in Jewish history. You need a mazel when you're born, too, and what time you live in. That's why Chazal said, Dor V'Dorshov, Dor V'Chachomov. It's the generation that you're in.
And if I'm reading...
My grandchildren don't experience that.
They just don't experience.
They go to Israel, they bar mitzvah in Israel, they study in Israel, some even settle in Israel, but it's not the same.
And if I'm reading...
I have no complaints, but it just can't be.
And if I'm reading your biography correctly, that Friday night we're referring to was shortly after your bar mitzvah.
It was shortly after my bar mitzvah, yes.
So imagine your teenage years are watching the...
We used to, the sichas chulin in the yeshiva when I went we all knew every battle that the Israeli army fought. We knew every place on the map. You know, you would say latrun, we all knew what it meant.
Right.
You say latrun today, people think it's a tank museum. Okay.
There's a reason why it's a tank museum.
But people don't realize that there's a reason why.
And moving forward to what I asked originally regarding involvement in Israel, causes in Israel, I don't know, just the average balabus, as we would say, homeowners in a Jewish community being involved in things important to the state, whether it be political, charity work, etc. Similar to those days in Muncie, or today it's much different? How would you evaluate it?
Well, I came to Muncie at the time of the Yom Kippur War. That was a very narrow escape for us, very narrow. People didn't realize how narrow it was. I did, because I went to Israel. I was the head of the OU then, and we had to work with the Israeli army to get kosher rations. It's a whole story. But it was a very, very narrow thing. And we almost lost the whole thing. So when I came back, I tried to communicate that to the people. You know, look what we almost lost. And we lost it because of our overconfidence, because of our apathy, because of the fact that we were engaged in arguing about petty things and we don't keep our eye on the great thing. So that was a message that was able to exist, again, because of the time that existed then. That dissipated, right?
Right.
Today we argue about budgets and about the draft and about this and about that, and we think that that's the ball game, but it isn't.
Right.
It really isn't.
And I guess for the current generation, the only thing comparable would be the bus attacks and constant bombings of the early.
Yeah, but that having lived through, I'm in Israel. 17 years in Yerushalayim, with a bus blown up a block from me. I had the Moment Cafe was about a block away from me. We were walking home on a Saturday night, and people were maybe a half a block from where we were walking. The cafe blew up. All of that is it's not to be minimized, but it's no comparison to the mood or to the damage that the Yom Kippur War did us.
Right. No question about it. I remember my father saying to me whenever I'd be down about one of those bus attacks, he said, just remember, 30 minutes after everything's cleared away, life is back to normal right there. He says, I could take you back 40, 50, 60 years where life was a lot different.
And not only that, I remember a great Gadol told me in Yerushalayim after one of these troubles, he said that was 5 minutes at Auschwitz. He said.
That's right.
So that's a way of looking at it. You need a perspective. You have to see it in a perspective. I'm an inveterate Chicagoan. So I see the Chicago Tribune almost every day. In the Chicago Tribune, every day there's 15 shootings, 20 shootings, 10 murders, It's regular every day. It's much more dangerous to live in Chicago than to live in Jerusalem.
Right. Rabbi Berlwein is with us. The book is called Teach Them Diligently, The Personal Story of a Community Rabbi. Now, all the lectures and the thousands and thousands that are available through the Destiny Foundation, that's all an outgrowth of simply lecturing to high school students, or there's more to it than that?
No, it's not high school students. I began lecturing. I began teaching in all of my rabbinic positions, even before I moved to Miami Beach in Chicago. I was your uncles were in the shul that we had formed.
That's right.
And that I served ad hoc as a rabbi. I always taught, and I was always fascinated by history, and I taught history. And then when I came to Muncie, and we started our little shul, I made a history class for women. And it caught on. A lot of women came, and the husbands felt embarrassed that their wives should know more than they do. They don't realize that women always know more than they do. So after a while, the men came to me and they said, we want to have a history class too. I said, good. You want to have a history class? The women I teach free. The men have to pay a registration fee. The registration fee will go to the yeshiva. And so I don't know, it was $50 or $100 the registration fee. We had 30, 35 people signed up, but many of them were physicians. And doctors don't have a normal schedule. So after a few weeks, a number of them came and said, listen, we paid in our fee, but we can't always come. Can we send a tape recorder? So I said, yeah, you paid the fee, you can send a tape recorder. And they took the tapes, and then they came back after another few weeks, said, you know, we passed these tapes around in the hospital. We said, everybody's listening to them. They're terrific. We should do something with it. So I developed this tape, and it became the single largest source of support for the yeshiva outside of tuition and the banquet. And we sold hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of sets of these tapes. And then later, when I left the yeshiva and I went to Israel, and I made the Destiny Foundation 20 years ago, so then the Yerusha that I took from the yeshiva is that I would take the tapes with me, and they would belong to the Destiny Foundation. So since then, we have DVDs, we have CDs, MP3s, you know, we've made films, we made full-length documentaries, we made all sorts of things. And we've got YouTube, and we're in 350 schools all over the world as part of the curriculum. So it really found a niche in the Jewish educational system, both for adults and for certainly high schools, but even for the middle schools.
See, Rabbi Wein,
and I'm very proud of it.
Rabbi Wein, I would say by volume, the greatest Jewish educator in modern Jewish history, but you likely would be embarrassed by that.
Well, I don't know if I'm embarrassed. I don't know how accurate it is, but it is very important that Jews know the story of the Jewish people. Because if you know the story, you will be a better Jew. I have in my experience, I have Jews that have become more observant. I have Jews that have become more Jewish just by listening to the history tapes. And in the history tapes, I do not discuss religion, and I do not discuss observance. That's not what the tape is. It's
right.
Not what the focus is. But it's an automatic thing because you stand back and you see, I mean, it's 3,500 years, and you know, this must be something. I have a course called The Crash Course in Jewish History, 5,000 years in 5 hours.
We're big fans of that one.
So everybody, you know, in 5 hours, all of a sudden you realize what it is to be a Jew.
I'll tell you, it's really amazing. Of all the series, and I know that this is an unfair question, but you must humor me for a moment. Of all the series and topics and holy books that you've spoken about and personalities and street names and every, I mean, the amount is absolutely incredible. Of all of it, is there a favorite? You would love to be lecturing in what arena of our tradition and or history if you had the choice?
I love people. Personal stories of people because, the Torah describes itself as a Sefer Toldos Adam. This is the book of people. I have five lectures on great people that I knew, the Ponovizhirov, the Satnerov, Rabbi Soloveitchik, Rabbi Rosenberg, Rabbi Yaakov. That moves me. And now I have a series that I'm doing. I mean, you'll excuse my commercial.
Please.
But I'm doing conversations. Discussing, just a conversation with somebody that opens up a world to people. I had a conversation with Dr. Tversky. I had a conversation with Yehuda Avner. I had a conversation with Dr. Almond, the Nobel Prize winner. I had a conversation with Rabbi Moshe Kamenetsky. I had a conversation with Rabbi Fran. I'm doing Conversation tonight in Englewood with Dr. J.J. Schachter. I'm doing Conversation Wednesday with Rabbi Pelkovitz in the White Show. Because these are rare people, most of whom from a different time, even though they are all active today, but with a different perspective. And, I think that it's enormously important. I think it's enormously beneficial. So we have these conversations, and I'm doing a whole series. I think there are 12 or 14 of them now already. So I like people. I really like people.
You know, it's interesting because in the book, Teach Them Diligently, if one were to line up all the different personalities, all the different people, historical figures that you actually met with, the list is a mile long. It's incredible. And, you know, like...
I was in the right place at the right time. If you're in Miami Beach in the winter, in the 1960s, the whole world comes to you.
And if I may, I mean, when you write, for instance, about Rabbi Riff, who was so important to my family, and Ramosha Feinstein, who lived a block away from where I'm sitting right now, and you mentioned Rabbi Kitov, and you mentioned Rabbi Jacobowitz, and of course Rabbi Norman Lamb, and Rabbi Teitz, who was so important to where I grew up in the New Jersey area, and that's just a small little taste of Rabbi Leo Young, of some of the people you came in touch with. One would have to conclude that you have a certain, I don't know, would you call it open, or a certain curiosity that even if someone, I don't know, is not on the same.
Well, I'll tell you that in spite of everything, I like Jews. And I like all types of Jews.
And you want to hear what they have to say.
I've always, I inherited that from my grandfather, who was a Volozhiner, a Talmud. He didn't differentiate. You know, I can disagree with you. But that doesn't mean I don't like you. It doesn't mean that you don't have something to say, something to contribute. So I can have a conversation with Rabbi Kamenetsky, and I can have a conversation with Rabbi Friend. I also have a conversation with Rabbi Shlomo Riskin. I also have a conversation with Yehuda Avner. I like all kinds of Jews because, you know, everybody, Jewish people, somebody once told me, are a symphony orchestra, right? So there's a guy in the back in the symphony orchestra, the timpani player, he hits one note, you know, if you go see a Beethoven symphony, you go to hear it, he hits one note in an hour.
Right.
So here's Avraham Rubin, then what do you need him for?
Right.
The answer is that one note is what makes Beethoven.
Right.
And that's true of the Jewish people. There's a guy that can only hit one note, but that note is what we needed. I don't think there are people that are superfluous, and therefore I had every relationship possible, you know. I mean, I had a very good relationship with the Satmar Rav, and I had a very good relationship with Rabin, whom I also knew. Not to compare, you know, but it's all part of that symphony orchestra that's called the Jewish people.
Talk about what might be one of the most important lessons to teach grandchildren or great-grandchildren through this book, communicating with all, appreciating them all, respecting them all.
Right, and to do so without having to give up any of your principles as well.
Right. Don't raise oneself up by knocking the other one down. Just maintain one's own principles.
Again, that's the point of self-confidence that I mentioned to you before, how important that is. If you know who you are and you have your idea, your self-image. So, you know, we grew up at a time when we all went to public school. You have to, if you wanted to remain Jewish, you have to work at it. Today, I can only say, even though there are great temptations, my grandchildren don't have to work at it the way I have to work at it.
Right. Plus, they have 700,000 kosher products from one agency.
That's right. So, you know, what's the problem?
Rabbi Wein, according to his biography, has done something in his life that I am jealous of. You were actually a guest on the Larry King Show more than once.
Yes.
That's
before Larry King was Larry King and before Rabbi Wein was Rabbi Wein.
I'm a big King fan. In fact, some of the things that he does I've emulated over the years. I've never been able to communicate that to him except through an indirect source once or twice.
He was when I knew him, when he started out in Miami on the radio, he was great. I mean, I can't tell you what an interviewer he was. And so I was, I think I wrote it in the book that I was on the show December 24th at night.
Right.
You can imagine, they didn't have much of an audience.
Christmas Eve.
Right. And the first question that he asked me is, what do I think of the Christian Savior?
Talk about, I don't even want to use the expression I was thinking of, but talk about being tossed into the fire immediately.
Right.
So how would you evaluate him as an interviewer? Is he a 10 out of 10 in your opinion?
He was terrific. He was absolutely terrific.
A nice Jewish boy, huh?
Yeah, yeah. And there was a lot to him. You know, it wasn't just celebrity. There was a lot to him. One thing, whatever subject he spoke about, it was obvious that he researched it. If he talked about a book, he had read, if he didn't read the whole book, but he had seen, read the book. It wasn't, it wasn't just fluff.
Yeah.
And I was very impressed by that. He himself, he went through a lot of problems in his life. He did not have an easy life.
Yeah, no question about that. And got the name King because of a Miami newspaper.
That's right.
Which was, life is funny, as they say. Rabbi Beryl Wein's brand new book is Teach Them Diligently. We are highly recommending it. It is brand new from Magid, a division of Koren Publishers, Jerusalem. We always recommend to go to the website at korenpub.com, korenpub.com. Rabbi Wein, of course, founder and director of the Destiny Foundation, but so many amazing and incredible stops along his journey through life. Now he's in the Holy Land. In Israel, where he continues to educate so many, and of course, in his early years, first as a corporate lawyer, and then as a rabbi in Miami, in Muncie, New York, and with the OU, the Destiny Foundation, as we mentioned, after the founding of the high school up in Muncie. There's just so many different stops and so many incredible things that you'll find intriguing. Plus, the personalities, and this is a personal dream of mine to one day write about all the incredible people I've spoken to, including Rabbi Wein, but the personalities that he either spoke to or met as a youth or later in life, just incredible. You will find this book to be fascinating, the personal story of a community rabbi. And as you mentioned earlier, Rabbi Wein, you are not discouraging anybody with the talent and with the personality to go into the rabbinate even in 2014.
You have to know yourself.
Right.
That's the main thing.
And I guess the thick skin would be either in the talent or personality category.
That's part of the personality.
Right.
And I met somebody on the street who told me, Rabbi, I didn't like what you said last Shabbos. And I said, I didn't like it either, but I had to speak.
Hi.
Yeah, so he didn't like it, Okay.
You were in full agreement, at least.
That's right. I was, who said you have to like it?
And finally, Rabbi Wein, as always, I leave you with a Windy City reference. There is definitely a lesson to be learned by the plight of the Chicago Cubs. We just don't know yet what
now,
that
was. Listen, the Chicago Cubs, that's theology. That's not baseball.
Right. You always point that out. It's a completely different category.
That's right.
I wish you a mazel tov, and thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Nachum, and be matzliach in regards to the whole family.
I appreciate that very much. Rabbi Beryl Wein, the brand new book, Teach Them Diligently, the personal story of a community rabbi. It is always a delight to speak to Rabbi Wein. And here we've had an opportunity on this segment of By the Book. I thank our friends at Koren Publishers and Magid Books. Go to korenpub.com, korenpub.com. I saw some of the advanced promotion for this book, and I guarantee you they'll be doing a lot of it because there are going to be people all around the world who are going to want to make sure to read Rabbi Beryl Wein's autobiography. Teach Them Diligently, the personal story of a community rabbi, and, of course, we are highly recommending it. My name is Nachum Siegel, and it's always a pleasure to bring you some incredible authors from our friends at Koren Publications and Magid Books during this segment entitled By the Book, which you can hear in its original form Tuesdays, 10 a.m. Eastern Time on our stream at NachumSiegel.com. This is the Nachum Siegel Network. Mm-hmm.